Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the TLS. Alongside me is commissioning editor Thea Lenarduzzi. Thea, we're now barely a week away from a general election in this country, which will crop up, I think, in this podcast. Are you excited, thrilled, enjoying the great democratic festival?
I'm not sure those are the words. Exhausted is probably
the
word.
You're already exhausted.
If we could now cut to that clip of Brenda from Bristol.
Yeah.
Play that.
I know. Just for people who don't know, this was a woman who was interviewed by the BBC the day after, or the day of the election being announced, and she said how sick of it she already was. This is a short election campaign, but it does feel, I know it's just, you say, exhausting, because compared to the American election campaign, which takes 2 years, and the normal election campaign, which in this country is kind of 2 months normal.
Oh, I know, but it comes a year after
referendum.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I think just exhausted is another word I want to come back to, just because I can't believe that Theresa May was exhausted after her 2.5 mile walk that led her to call a snap general election.
Yeah, she did a U, didn't she? The shortest walk. She went wandering around the British countryside, and as a result, she decided to call a general election.
Yeah, 2.5 miles, and that's what happened. Imagine if she went on a proper long walk.
What did you do?
Well, I didn't really make any decisions when I walked.
All
for
you
60
did was
miles.
Have thoughts about cheese. And that is the difference between you and Theresa
That's
May.
That's why I will not enter politics.
There may be other differences also. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, do Google TLS subscriptions and type POD1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the podcast this week, on June the 5th, 1967, the Six-Day War began between Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq and Syria. It was a tremendous and perhaps surprising military success for Israel and led to that country seizing the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, thus establishing the boundaries of the territorial dispute that exists to this day. We have several pieces commemorating the 50th anniversary of this event, and our political editor, Toby Lichtig, will be speaking to the Israeli author, Asaf Gavron. Foxes have made a surprise appearance in this year's general election campaign, oddly enough, with Prime Minister Theresa May indicating that she wouldn't mind seeing one or two torn apart by the odd pack of hounds, urged on by horsey types in red coats. Yoicks, as I believe the expression is, certainly the one used by the wonderful Aunt Dahlia in the Jeeves and Wooster books. Tom Holland, historian and preserver of British fauna, has written a piece for us about foxes and their cultural identity, and we'll be speaking to us later. Whither Wagner? That is a question we might reasonably also consider today. Is there a figure of high culture more beloved by some while being utterly disregarded by others? Our opera critic Guy Demann has shown impressive intellectual stamina by not only sitting through an entire Ring cycle, but also reading a book on Wagner by Roger Scruton. He'll be explaining the magic for us. On June the 5th, 1967, the world shifted once more. The Six-Day War, which has led to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip and more, fundamentally altered the power politics of the Middle East and has set the battleground of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that persists with great tragedy and sorrow to this day, 50 years on. This week's TLS commemorates that anniversary with a number of pieces. We have Yuri Dromi, Yitzhak Rabin's former press secretary, reviewing a new biography of Rabin, a man who Bill Clinton believes would have brought peace to the region had he not fallen to an assassin's bullet. Ari Shavit has written a long piece telling not only of his own experience of the war, but the social, political and military consequences that followed. Lina Al-Safan, a Palestinian journalist, recalls life in Palestinian schools where children read histories of their nation sanctioned by the Israeli government. And finally, we're extracting Asaf Gavron's essay on the subject of the Palestinian football team, taken from Kingdom of Olives and Ash, a book of essays edited by Michael Chabon and Eilert Waldman, published this week. Toby Lichtig spoke to Gavron earlier and asked why it was possible to tell the story of the Palestinian situation through its football team.
There's something about football that is beyond life. It's beyond borders and beyond nations, the most popular game on earth. Because of that, I think it has this power to pass over those differences. And when you look into it, it gives you a way to understand things. For me, when I was asked to contribute to this book of essays marking 50 years of the occupation, being Israeli who lived all his life in this situation and knows everything about it and read about it every day, I think for me football was a way to look at it differently.
You talk about it passing over, but it is of course a very political thing. You know, sport can be political in any country, but particularly in Israel-Palestine, the way you've talked about, the way football's used, it is more than just a game, isn't it?
Not only in Israel and Palestine, there's a great book by Simon Cooper, Football Against the Enemy, that goes over the world and talks about, you know, conflict from Honduras to Russia to all over. And in Palestine, it's been fascinating for me. That's one of the aspects of the piece, not all of it, but fascinating how the Palestinians used football as a diplomatic tool, and especially in FIFA, where they are considered a national entity, which is one of the only places where they are considered so. And through that, they can put a lot of pressure on Israel.
So it's tremendously symbolically important, isn't it, that they're recognized by this body as a nation?
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, had, according to his office, he had a 30-minute conversation with the president of FIFA. Now, the Prime Minister of Israel, he has pressure from everywhere, from everyone, but he took the time to speak to the president of FIFA because he understood this symbolic power. If FIFA recognizes Palestine as a nation and tells Israel, well, you are breaking our rules and you're in danger of losing, you know, your membership, losing the right to play in, you know, the World Cup qualifiers or so, then it shows how Israel fears this development.
And how long has Palestine been recognized by FIFA in this way? And also, how did it happen?
I think it's since 1998. 2 years earlier, in 1996, the Palestinians were recognized also by the Olympic Committee. And 1996 was the first time they sent a team to the Olympics. How it happened, I think it was in the 90s, there was the Oslo peace process, the peace agreement. There was a recognition by Israel, too, of the Palestinian Authority as the representative of the Palestinian people. And they were given, through this peace process, some power over some of the cities in the West Bank, which they still have. And part of that process was recognition in other areas.
Have you ever seen the Palestinian national team play then?
Not in real life. I've seen a lot of videos, and there's a great documentary about them.
Are they any good?
They have been doing really well. Actually, last year they jumped in their FIFA ranking from 100, I don't remember exactly, but 140-something to 110 or so, which is a huge jump. It happened mainly thanks to their success in the World Cup qualifiers. They play in the Asia qualifiers. Yes,
well, Israel plays in Europe. It's quite curious, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very curious. Israel is considered European in sports and in the Eurovision, but of course it's not really part of Europe. But that's another question. But yeah, Palestine it plays in Asia, and they finished third in a group of five, with the teams being above them being quite good teams like Saudi Arabia.
And that's in spite of certain obstacles that's put before them. I wonder if you could just briefly tell me the kind of difficulties Palestinian players face.
That's right. That's another kind of aspect of football. You know, the regular occupation story, I say regular, horrible and sad, but things like not being able to move freely from place to place, like teams not being able to cross, including the national team. Some players are detained when they try to cross the border to play international games. And also another, what I call a regular aspect of the occupation, is arrests of players, just sometimes random arrests. It's just this mechanism of occupation that, you know, read about in all aspects of life. And,
so I suppose in this light, being kind of in the early hundreds in the rankings is a particular success story for Palestine, and a nation that doesn't all too often enjoy success stories of this nature. It's a happy story.
Yeah, it's almost unbelievable. Also, the way this team is being kind of developed and managed. There are Palestinians who are expats who come in from the US or from Chile. There's a big contingency in Chile, apparently, and they, a lot of them play football there. And then some who play in the Israeli league, and then some who play in the Palestinian league, which is also another amazing story, the very exciting league, despite all those difficulties and hardships of moving around.
That was Asaf Gavron in conversation with Toby Lichtig. Kingdom of Olives and Ash is published by Fourth Estate. Toby is still here with us. Toby, let's talk about some of the other pieces that appear. We've got a few commemorating this 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War and therefore the Israeli occupation. What struck you in any of the other pieces? What else would you draw attention to?
Well, I think what struck me is a general tone of resignation and mild desperation at the catalogue of terrible political decisions and missed opportunities over 50 years and even sort of beyond that. But there's also hope.
Do you think there is? Because one thing I found was that there seems to be a suggestion that the solution that may have been close in the 90s or felt like it was becoming close in the 90s feels further away than ever.
It feels further away than ever, but we did get there in the 90s, and we almost got there again about 15 years ago in 2001, and these things can move very quickly. So although I can't foresee anything happening, I mean, it's always impossible to tell with these things. And I don't know. I mean, the hope that I took from it, okay, there were various things. There's Lina Al-Safin's piece. She's a wonderful young Palestinian journalist who wrote about the kind of, you know, the cohesiveness of the Palestinian nation. So despite the fissures, despite, you know, you've got Hamas on one side in Gaza, and you've got a different political entity in the West Bank, but she talks about the way Palestine can unite around its cultural icons, and that seemed very hopeful in terms of...
Even when Palestinian children are learning Israeli history.
Absolutely, yeah. But, you know, there is one curriculum now, which is an advancement on what they used to be, and despite a degree of censorship and Israeli interference, there is a sense of Palestinian solidarity, which I think will help them tremendously. And then you've got Yuri Dromi, who wrote a wonderful piece on Yitzhak Rabin, and it's not the most optimistic piece in the world, and you're right to say that, you know, the Oslo Accords are as close as we've ever got, and we're certainly far away from that now. But there was a line that struck me that he wrote. He said, the quest for peace is really the quest for security. And actually that pragmatic attitude is incredibly important. And I think understanding that is the key to understanding the solution. And I think there are enough sensible people in Israel to sort of pursue that line. It's just a question of whether they...
But not running Israel, you might
say. Well, but not running Israel at the moment, and that is a problem.
I think that the piece by Ari Shavit, that really, I think, to me, made clear how everything can seem its opposite.
Absolutely.
So he has that line in it where he says, paradoxically, the Six-Day War also opened the road to peace, and then goes through the why. Everything that seems bad can also have the opposite effect.
Absolutely. So he calls it a curse within a blessing for Israel and a blessing within a curse for Palestine. And the reason for that is, you know, it looked like this tremendous victory in 1967, and it set the path for the peace accords with Egypt and Jordan. But actually, it also sowed the seeds of many of the current problems by encouraging this kind of messianic fervour. And then...
It was too dominant, effectively.
Surprising and too dominant a victory. And then there was a failure to let go. And there was a failure... Even Moshe Dayan, you know, the hardline Israeli general who was desperate for this war, even he thought the territory should be let go sooner rather than later. And the real thing it did was fan the flames of this religious fervour. So, you know, this sense that the lands of Judea and Samaria It says in the Bible, this is the, these should be run by the Jewish people.
It created the climate for a party like the Likud party.
Exactly, which is... absolutely. So there were the seeds of the Likud party, which is currently in power, and Netanyahu is the prime minister, and he's the head of the Likud party. I mean, the seeds of that actually go back to the 30s, and a certain, and I stress certain, fascist strain in Zionism. You know, a lot of Zionism, early Zionism, was very left-wing. It's funny, we think of Israel now as a right-wing country, yeah. But it was, you know, it had its seeds in socialism and communism, and there were various relations with the sort of early Soviet state, but there was also a very right-wing fascist strain in elements of Zionism, and that's where the Likud's come out of, and that's what 67 kind of helped to usher
and that's
in.
What it feels like there is today, because you and I have spoken about this before, where this notion of, can you imagine an Israeli politician in the next 5 years effectively campaigning on a ticket that says, we are going to consider the two-state solution. We're going to give up this land. We're going to give up this land. And at the minute, with under Netanyahu, that doesn't feel very likely, does it?
No, it doesn't feel very likely. And, you know, the one of the main problems is the Israeli right, the Israeli religious right. And, you know, they're a very powerful bloc, and he's got to pander to them. But it's very, you know, it's very hard to say what would happen. Asaf says in his piece, you know, it's taken 50 years and I'm not convinced it won't take another 50 years, but it will end because it has to end. It's completely untenable as much as anything else.
And this year is, in fact, it's an anniversary year for the two-state solution as well, because it's 80 years since, was it the Peel Report first suggested a two-state solution back in 1937, and then the UN took that onto its kind of books in 1947.
Yes.
So, I mean, where are we now? Because every time you look it up, it's looking less likely.
In a way, we're closer to a two-state solution than we were in 1947. There's a fantastic line from Shavit, and it really crystallised everything for me. He said, before the war, the conflict, this is before the Six-Day War, the conflict between Israel and the Arab world was existential and therefore insoluble. A few years after, it became territorial and then soluble. And where we are now is it is territorial. And the arguments over the years have been over little bits of territory.
That's the good within the bad.
That's the good within
sense.
The bad, yeah. Absolutely.
But that's why I find it interesting, because if you don't have a two-state solution, and Trump is kind of not helpful in this either, he sort of started talking about a two-state solution being effectively dead. A one-state solution, which is a territorial solution, is pretty much apartheid. Ultimately, it's one side winning and the other side being crushed.
You can
crushed.
Argue that that's already the case, though, in vast swathes.
Well, it is.
It is to a certain extent, but there is no democratic one-state solution, and that would always be a disaster for Israel if it is to remain a Jewish state, which is in its very fabric, because, you know, as soon as Arabs are outnumbering Jews, then it can no longer be a Jewish state. So there is no possibility of there ever being a democratic one-state, single state. It's just...
And it's hard to imagine, even... philosophically, either side really wanting one, because at some point one side's going to be dominant over the other, and the other side is not going to want that.
Absolutely. So I've met Palestinians, you know, certain Palestinians on the left who kind of talk about a one state, and I've met certain left wing Jews who also think there should be one state. But I've just never understood how that could possibly work. I think two states, preferably democratic ones, coexisting peacefully and not killing each other is the only really real way to go.
And we don't know when that will happen. Toby, thank you so much for joining. It's a really interesting group of thoughts on this. It's a bit, maybe a bit depressing, but you think there's a glimmer of hope.
I didn't find it depressing either.
Okay.
I also found, I mean, you know, some of the pieces are coming from the left in Israel or whatever, but I do think there's a tremendous power on the Israeli left and a real desire to see things change. And although Netanyahu's still in the ascendancy, things change.
And I think what that Ari Shavit did, sorry, just the final note, so well was to, I mean, for the first three columns on the page of his piece, he's giving his perspective and what it felt like as a child to gather around the radio and hear reports of war and invasion. And then he flips it to a completely different account, a much more balanced account, but also one that is much less flattering of his side. So to speak.
Absolutely. And,
it just goes to show the perspectives and the ability to see things from the other side, which is...
Seeing it not as a binary is the only way that any solution can really be resolved.
Toby Lishtig, thank you very much indeed. No wild animal plays a more significant or ambivalent role in the imaginings of the British than the fox. So says Tom Holland, historian, animal fancier and cricket bore on social media. Do follow him on Twitter if you're interested in tales of his sporting tribulations with bat and ball.
Why is that, is a question, as it relates to foxes, we shall be considering with him. Because the impact of this vividly reddy-orange creature has been felt throughout history and across different cultures. Aesop's fox, as Tom reminds us, was a cunning blighter a couple of thousand years ago. And the Irish word shenanigans, this is brilliant, I think, may well come from the Gaelic phrase meaning I play the fox. Foxes are, of course, political once more. In Great Britain, the Conservative Manifesto proposes a free vote in the House of Commons on the return to fox hunting, made illegal under Tony Blair. And a crushing Tory majority would, in all likelihood, mean the ban being repealed. Fox hunting is one of those emotional issues always blown up beyond its realistic importance, acting as a proxy for rows between old and young, rural and urban, posh and not so posh. In any event, it's hard to think of an animal more capable of arousing artistic and political feeling than the fox. Tom Holland joins us now to discuss some more. Tom, thank you for being on the show.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Before we get to politics, let's discuss the animal's impact on our imagination. You mentioned Aesop, but Chaucer tells a sort of rattling fox story in the Nun's Priest tale. Ben Jonson gave us Volpone, that cunning so-and-so, and Belle and Sebastian sang about Fox in the Snow, one of their songs. Why do you think they've loomed so large in all our collective imaginations?
Because I think they are uniquely suited to playing an ambivalent role. Some of the examples that you gave, so the Nun's Priest tale, the fox is the villain. It tries to grab Chanticleer, and clearly we're siding with the cockerel. But if you think of Aesop's fables, which you cited, but also Roald Dahl's Fantastic Mr. Fox,
yeah,
we're encouraged to side with the fox as an example of supreme cunning. But he's kind of the Odysseus of the natural world. So I think that it is an animal of immense character. It looks striking. It behaves in striking ways. And for all those reasons, we are encouraged to either to identify with it or to dread it.
Are they lovable, do you think?
I don't think they are lovable, and I think that again is one of the reasons for the hold it has on our imagination, because what the fox gives us, and perhaps particularly for those of us who live in cities where we can really feel divorced from the natural world, what it gives us is a glimpse of the authentically wild. They are not cute. Maybe fox cubs are, but in general, if you see an adult fox rifling through the bins or stalking along the wall of a garden, there's a faint hint of the primordial carnivores that we've lost, I think. The lynx, the wolf, the bear.
Yeah.
A reminder of the world in which nature is actually red in tooth and claw.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing with foxes is, as you said, not only their ambivalence as characters, but their ambivalence in that we can never quite grasp them and decide what they are. I mean, the foxes that you've mentioned in London, I mean, they're not authentically wild, really, in that they're actually sort of dependent on us and our litter. So they're both wild, you know, both urban and of the natural world. People surprisingly quite often are confused as to whether they're more like cats or more like dogs, which is quite
yeah.
an interesting thing to wonder about, because those are sort of taken as being opposites.
But I think one of the things about the fox is that, unlike most other wildlife, they're not actually dependent on conservation measures. We have to go to great efforts to try and conserve an animal even as iconic as the hedgehog. With foxes, they subsist without any attempts by us to look after us. And it's absolutely right. If they're coming into the towns, then, of course, they tend to be preying on discarded Big Macs.
But well, they're almost vermin, aren't they?
They're not doing it because we are donating food to them. Mm. They are scavenging off us. And out in the countryside, they live without our sufferance, and there are very few animals that you can say that of anymore.
And I suppose, and people are, you know, whenever you talk to people about foxes, if people have ever kept chickens,
yeah,
you mentioned foxes, and they're appalled because it's said they're an animal that kills for the joy of it rather than just for hunger.
Well, you say that. I mean, that's a very emotive way, and it makes it sound like a kind of serial killer that is exulting in spilling blood. I think that is unfair. I mean, what it is doing is obeying its natural instincts as an animal. And when it kills all those chickens, it's doing it to store them up for later times. I mean, you come in, I know, my brother keeps chickens and actually has given up because the foxes have killed so many of his chickens. So it is a horrible thing to come in and see what seems to be an absolutely random killing, but it's not true. The fox is doing what foxes do.
Well, let's get on to the idea of hunting them, because that is a political issue now. Why is it so divisive, do you think? Because in some ways, a debate about rural matters like this wouldn't excite that many people. In a way that, say, the badger cull for tuberculosis doesn't necessarily excite this level of political excitement. What is it about hunting that's so divisive, do you think?
Well, again, I've been saying that what the fox gives people in Britain, I think, uniquely is an authentic taste of nature as it used to be back in the primordial days when humans first settled this island. And hunting is a key aspect of what nature is about. Humans were once a part of that ecosystem. The thrill of the hunt comes very naturally to those who are naturally predators, and humans certainly are predators. Foxes are predators. The thrill of hunting an animal is deep wired into our very nature. So when people are galloping across the countryside in pink coats,
red. Are they not red? Have I imagined?
Yeah, but they're
that?
Called they're red coats, but they're called pinks. Supposedly, because it derives from Thomas Pink.
Oh, really?
Supposedly, I'm sure you'll get readers writing in and complaining about it. But I think that when fox hunters are galloping across the countryside, they are satisfying that primordial urge. Equally, we have tended to sentimentalise nature now and sentimentalise animals. And so there is that tension that we, precisely because we no longer depend on the hunt for our food, it has come to seem as though continuing that tradition is unnecessary and bloodthirsty and cruel.
Well, I think, and also the British in particular pride themselves on being these animal lovers.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an interesting, in Lucy Jones's book, she brings these two sides together, the thrill of the hunt and then the love of animals. She brings these together in the paradoxical figure of her grandfather. I find the description of her grandfather really difficult to understand.
Well, he was a committed member of the RSPCA, but equally a committed hunter.
That's what I find. I can't reconcile those two things.
Well, I think the truth is that if you look at the way that throughout history, and particularly throughout mythology, there has always been a sense of identification between humans and those that they hunt, it seems to me the likeliest explanation for what is going on in prehistoric cave art, that in some way the cave artists are paying a kind of homage to the animals that they have hunted. And so I have never gone fox hunting, and I have no wish to go fox hunting, but I can absolutely accept what Lucy Jones says in her book, that it is possible for those who do go fox hunting in some way to love the fox.
And respect it. There's something about this notion that, I mean, to me it sounds very odd, but the idea is it's almost respecting its place in the hierarchy, and although that does involve it being hunted to death, it's still seen as part of the ecosystem that they voluntarily inhabit. Well, I'm interested, though, Tom, why would the Tories want to resurrect this debate at all? It seems to me that if you support hunting, you already vote Tory. It's not going to win you any votes.
And no idea what the Tories are doing with their campaign, this election.
It's an absolute mystery.
You know, if there's a fish in a barrel, their ability to miss shooting it seems eerie.
Let's hunt the fish.
But it doesn't make any sense, does it? Because I think the only people who would care enough about it to influence their vote are probably young urban people who would say, I'm not voting for a bunch of toffs on horses. And that view of the Tories sort of telegraph reading Colonel Blimps in the Shires, this policy becomes completely symbolic of that, doesn't it? Whether rightly or wrongly.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a kind of a desire to appeal to an old-fashioned pre-EU Britain that we may be returning to with Brexit. Who knows? I have no idea what they were thinking of with that.
Yeah, the great nostalgia. Well, there's an argument, Tom, that nostalgia is now the driving force in all of our politics.
Well, fox hunting is key in that. And I think not only for fox hunting men and women, but also I think for saboteurs, for whom, and again, Lucy James' book makes this very clear, there was an element of sport in trying to stop the hunts for both, you know, huntsmen and saboteurs. The thrill of going out on a hunt day and in a sense having a quarry was a key part of it. And
And possibly playing out a class dispute in some ways, in the same way the poacher poachers against the gamekeeper.
There are kinds of venerable tensions there. So class is an obvious one, but also, of course, the tension between town and country.
Just finally, before you go, Tom, you also review a book, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you the science of this in any great detail, but How to Tame a Fox and Build a Dog, which is about an experiment that's been going on in Russia since 1959, which is to domesticate the fox. Your reviews are accompanied by this big picture of these fox dog cubs, which are the cutest things you can imagine. What's the point of this? Because this sounds fascinating and kind of oddly convincing. Is the idea that you can enact what happened to wolves becoming dogs with foxes?
Well, essentially, it's an attempt to understand the process by which domestication may have occurred, the process by which wolves may have become sufficiently domesticated to live alongside humans, and to track the science of it. And it's a remarkable experiment. And the speed with which foxes have been transmuted into the kind of thing that you might get in a Disney cartoon is astonishing.
Is there any conclusion we can draw from that, or just simply that that's what we've done to wild animals like wolves, and that's what is possible for humans to do?
I thought the most remarkable thing that I learned from reading it was that tame foxes turn out to have much higher levels of serotonin than feral foxes. So it may be that being domesticated is the equivalent of going to a nightclub and taking ecstasy.
Well, on that bombshell, Tom, let's leave it there. Tom Hallin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You don't strike me as a natural huntswoman, Thea Leonard. Is that fair? Is that a fair assumption?
I think that's a fair assumption.
Have you ever done it?
No.
Have you ever sabotaged a hunt?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't done that either. And, I probably should. I feel so strongly
well,
for
I'm
it.
Well, I'm from Loughborough. The village next door to Loughborough is Quorn. And the Quorn hunt is a thing, apparently. Yeah.
But they're not hunting Quorn.
No. They'd probably do that now. They just hunt a giant piece of corn. But what's interesting is it never really impacted on my life whatsoever, because I'm not from the circles. That's why I do think it's very class-ridden. There's
a
certain type of person goes fox hunting, and it's not ordinary people, which is why I think it's a very strange Tory policy, because who are you appealing to with it? Outright libertarians, who I think will find other things, battlefields to die on than this, and people who are going to vote Tory anyway.
I can only imagine she and Theresa May, she who must not be named, and the rest of her party just thought, well, we may as well. It's something that they've spoken about for ages and ages, and it's a safe thing to make those people feel that, the pink coats feel very happy and really riled.
And they haven't really changed their policy, because the policy's always been to have a free vote on it at some point.
Yeah.
And it just means it's more likely now because they could get a majority.
Yeah, and it's perfect for the cover of the Daily Mail.
See, is the Daily Mail going to be pro-fox hunting? Are they going to care enough? That's what I'm saying. It doesn't seem to appeal to enough people.
Mm.
I think it's a really funny thing, because if you speak to some people about it, they will say, I will never vote for a party that supports fox hunting. I'm not sure you'd say I'll only vote for the party that supports foxing. You have a very funny set of priorities. What do you care about most in terms of the national debate?
Yeah, let's butcher some poor foxes.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There can be few cultural artefacts more forbidding to the amateur, the casual customer, than Wagner's Ring Cycle. More so than Alarish Schirsch or Finnegan's Wake or War and Peace, which you can put down and read in your own time. Wagner's opera connotes immediately a sense of physical trial, of vast and unforgiving expanse, of a peculiarly Germanic, buttock-numbing toughness. As Blackadder says of the Germans at one point, and he might have been thinking of Wagner, the Teutonic reputation for brutality is well founded. Their operas last 3 or 4 days and they have no word for fluffy. There is, it would seem, nothing fluffy about Wagner. Our opera critic Guy Damon has been to see Stockholm's Royal Opera's version of Der Ring des Nibelungen, as well as reading 2 books on Wagner, The Ring of Truth by Roger Scruton and Being Wagner by Simon Callow. He joins Thea and me now. Guy, in this lovely big piece you've written for us this week, you refer to the need simply to listen to the music. I wonder if you might start by telling us briefly, if such a thing is possible with such a work as this, the story Wagner's trying to tell and the manner of its relationship to the music.
Well, the intro, very interesting, because you mentioned this idea that you know, Wagner's Ring is somehow even more unapproachable than, for example, A la recherche de ton perdu or Finnegan's Wake. You know, all these kind of modernist megaloths are somehow kind of more approachable than Wagner's Ring. And you know, there's some truth in that, in the sense that you need to spend, you know, 4 evenings in a theatre, and the shortest evening is a 3-hour opera with no interval. So it's a big commitment of time, but I think anybody who does commit that time finds that the time rushes along pretty quickly. So a good instance of how the music just carries you is if you just listen to the opening bars of the first opera, you soon find that you know, the musical imagery is so immediate. The musical world he opens us is just this opening gesture of just a bare fifth, barely audible in the double basses, and this growing mesh of sound, which sounds completely static, and yet kind of it's teeming with life, rather like a river in a way, sort of depicting the beginning of time. As soon as you get carried away by this flow of the music, suddenly, you're just suddenly there, and everything is done for you.
And the music is more important than really this story, which is kind of a fall of man story, a kind of origins of mythology story. Do you find, is it possible to say actually some of the goings on stage, the stage business, don't matter in comparison to the experience of just listening?
No, I think that's entirely false, in the sense that the music is the story. So there isn't a division, but there's no sense in which there's a story unfolding on stage and there's a music. You might have this idea of traditional opera, there's a story, often quite a silly one, and then people bring out various emotional qualities, or they add a symphonic aspect to all this or that. With Wagner, his idea and his execution is so integrated that as long as you give yourself into the music, then you can understand what the action is all about.
This is to do with his vision of the total work of art.
It is, which is an old idea, and it's not, you know, Wagner wasn't the first who had to do with opera who came up with this idea. This is part of the history of opera since its incarnation, is this idea of recapturing the total experience which everyone thought was afforded by the dramas of ancient Athens, or the Athenian festivals. Every art form is contributing to the meaning which you then can carry away, and which will reinvigorate your commitment to the polis.
And so then, can I ask on a much more general note, I mean, what was it about Wagner that sees him described again and again as so revolutionary, so radical?
Well, it is this degree of integration. And as I say, he's not the first to come up with the idea. I mean, he's the first to use the term Gesamtkunstwerk, but he's not the first to say that the ideal of opera is to be integrated. But he's the first, in a way, to take it quite so far. And he deals with mythic themes, so he's not dealing with untouched legends, he's not dealing with the stories that everybody already knows. He's dealing with stories that he's making from mythic elements. So all of his mature elements, all of his mature operas have this this feature. And it's the mythic aspect of the stories which embeds itself in the way that his music is conceived, as in itself being part of what tells the story and what gives the story's life and dynamism.
You went to see, Guy, a production in Stockholm, which I want to ask you about, but we should, before we do that, why don't we play a piece of it? So you picked something out, didn't you?
Yes, it's from the opening of the Götterdämmerung, which I think means Twilight of the Gods, and it's from the fourth and final part of the Ring. And I think, so the title's a translation into the German of the Old Norse phrase Ragnarok, which refers to this cataclysmic war that was supposed to lead to the renewal of the world.
And so we're going to hear a little passage of that, and then we'll talk to Guy about the production.
Guy, tell us about this production. What made it stand? Because it struck me reading your review, you felt this was a fine piece of musical theatre of opera. What made it stand out for you?
Well, several things. One is, to be honest, I don't go to ring cycles very often because I have small children. And
you have a life, Guy. You have a life.
It doesn't connect with the rhythm of family life very well. But having decided to go to this one, which is in a way it's my local opera house now, the things that stood out for me are, okay, there was this wonderful casting, this mixture of casting. So Stockholm is an opera house which has a big company of soloists in-house. So they when they cast an opera, they usually use people from in-house. And they have some wonderful singers. But they also used Nina Stemma, the Swedish dramatic soprano who tours and plays, she sings Brunhilde all over the world, as well as Isolde and several other Wagnerian heroines. Lars Klevman, also a Swedish, he's a rock star on the side, incidentally. He was singing Siegfried. John Lundgren, who is Swedish but also mostly operative and operates in Denmark. So they got some, you know, some pretty good names in the house. The house itself is a small house by modern opera house standards. So the feeling is quite intimate. If you have a good, the acoustic is not always great, but if you have a good line to the voices, wow, the sense of presence is extraordinary. So Nina Stemma singing her great peroration at the end of the whole cycle, this was just like being enveloped in the most extraordinary wave of sound.
And were you moved, really, Guy? Do you come out of this feeling moved?
In fact, the most moving, strictly speaking, of the operas is the second one, because that's the one in which the tragic aspect of the balance between the world of the gods and the world of the humans is most manifest. It's a more straightforward tragedy. There's these two twins, who, it sounds rather strange, they find each other. He's Sigmunda. He's been running. He's had a life cursed by terrible luck. He's found shelter, he's on the hunt from people trying to kill him, and he receives shelter from a woman who turns out to be his twin sister, separated at birth, but also his lover. And there's a great deal of funny things one might think about this, but there's a great purity to the idea, which is that these two are essentially made to be with each other. And if one, you know, discards the question about the legality and just relate to the emotions being played on stage, and then what happens to these lovers, which is, of course, they are not allowed to continue, and Sigmund is killed. And this is an intervention of one of the gods. It's very, very tragic, and in fact, it's the tragic note with which that opera ends, which is the kind of crowning theme for the end of the final opera. So this music comes back again. And because these, over the course of four evenings, you've lived with bits of music which keep on developing, which keep on coming back. By the end of the ring, they become like all these friends that you were just living with the whole time.
Briefly, because you review books about Wagner as well, what do the operas tell us about the man? I mean, we talked about Nietzsche on this podcast last week, and we had the conversation of whether he could be accused of anti-Semitism. Is that when people say Wagner because of how he's appropriated by the Nazis, in a similar way, you might say, to Nietzsche, is that... Do you always find yourself, Guy, when you say that you like the music, having to defend the man?
Yes, I do, because Wagner was an anti-Semite. In fact, in a rather more straightforward way than Nietzsche, I think. You have to put it to one side to a certain extent, because, of course, you know, Wagner's anti-Semitism is really rooted in a cultural current that was around at the time. He was a man who tended to radicalize every opinion that he had. So whatever he thought so much more extremely than everybody else. And there's a sense in which his anti-Semitism, you can just read it as a kind of, he's fastened on an aspect of his own character, which is the one that he's really ashamed of. This, you know, here he's this guy who's proclaiming, he's projecting an image of himself as the, you know, supreme, authentic artist, and he was in fact, you know, a wonderful mimic, and he spent an awful long time finding his voice, and he was terribly histrionic in his relationships, and not at all authentic or even sincere in many instances. So there's a sense in which it's all a big self-criticism or a sublimated self-criticism. But there's also a sense in which, well, you can't just put it to one side, because there is a sense in which the whole worldview, which is expressed in The Ring, has to have some connection to the worldview which allowed Jews and German Jews to be dehumanized in the eyes of ordinary German citizens. This is the big kind of mysterious aspect about how Nazism and the Holocaust could really come about. And no one should say that Wagner is to blame, or that Wagner is causal in this, or there's anything there, but there is a connection, and one can't simply say, let's forget about it.
Just finally, Guy, you're conscious you talk about you've got young kids, and therefore going to The Ring is a hard thing to do. What's the age you introduce young kids to Wagner?
Do you know what? It's perfect for teenagers, to be perfectly honest. Small kids, obviously, know it's too long. In a way, that, you know, the thing we all, you know, have or had as adolescents is this thing where we kind of take our emotions far too seriously. We can't withdraw ourselves from, you know, one emotional world to another. We stay really fastened on the objects of our attention. You know, in a way, you know, Wagner was an eternal adolescent who just hit on some of the, you know, deepest truths about man and freedom and love that have been expressed, I think, in the history of Western art, and they're all there in The Ring. But the mode of access is quite adolescent in a way.
Take your teenagers. Guy Dumman, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thea?
I think I'd like to be one of those teenagers. I'd like to be taken.
To Wagner.
To Wagner.
Do you feel that you've missed it a bit? I feel I've totally missed Wagner.
How can you miss it? I mean, it's...
I'm aware of it, and I've heard bits of it, and I remember sitting watching versions of it, like not in the theatre, but on the food. But I've just missed it as an experience.
So it's not gone anywhere. Though. No. So you can still. We could go. We could still go to see.
Should
Wagner.
We go and see 4 days? But we're not going to, are we? Really?
Gonna have 4 days off to go. there's the Opera North production that Guy
also
refers to in his piece,
and it's on iPlayer.
And that's on the iPlayer. And it's definitely something. It weighs on my conscience, and it's something I should
tend
to. I think
you need to be immersed. I think you almost need to go with Guy Dammann and him sit there and explain stuff to you, and just someone at some. Why teenagers are such a good idea? Because if you could go as a teenager and learn a bit about it, then be with you for all of your adult life. I can see that becoming a thing. It's just our age now. It seems an odd thing to. It seems quite a barrier to get into it.
Mm. Well, I think for that reason, Guy's piece is a useful one, as well as an interesting and pleasurable to read one, because you get a sense of this work and its complexity. But, you know, things like the fact that it took, I think, 25 or 26 years to compose and to come to fruition.
So we should probably
just think
listen
of
to
just
it,
think yeah just think of how many things changed in Wagner's life.
Yeah.
Politically, culturally. I'd love to have a deeper understanding in order to then be able to go and listen to the music and find resonances.
Well, you better get going then.
I know. Goodbye.
Goodbye. That's all we have time for this week. Thea has to go and learn all about German operatic culture before spending 4 days in the theatre. Our thanks go to Tom Holland, Asaf Gavron, Toby Lischtig and Guy Dammann. Do go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of The Paper, which is led by an essay by none other than film director Martin Scorsese, who we're extremely proud to have as a TLS contributor. Give yourself a treat and look that up. And do tweet this podcast at @FBFM_podcast with your comments and thoughts. Please do review us on iTunes. Two. Next week, we shall be tackling that ever-relevant and weighty topic, the true meaning of Islam. Don't say we don't cover all bases here on this podcast. Until then, from Theo and from me, goodbye.